Committee on Ways and Means, the Subcommittee on Public Safety. Today is March 6th, 2017, and I'm going to open up a work session on the Department of Corrections federal grant application request, and I know that Jeremiah is there. You want to give us the narrative first before we hear from you?
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair, committee members. The Department of Corrections is here before you to ask your approval to apply for up to $750,000 from the U.S. Department of Justice's Bureau of Justice Assistance for evidence-based probation and parole practices. Jeremiah Stromberg, who's the Assistant Director for Community Corrections, is here to talk to you about the grant.
Well, good afternoon, Chair Winters, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jeremiah Stromberg. I'm the Assistant Director for the Community Corrections Division of the Department of Corrections. And I'm here today to request authority for the department's submission of a federal grant application to the U.S. Department of Justice, actually in the amount of $343,775. First, I want to thank you for your time, and I certainly don't want to take away from the state police and their presentation, so I will be very quick. I do want to thank Julie Naburka for assisting us with getting on this agenda with such a short timeline. This grant required coordination across 36 counties as well as the Department of Corrections. And as you can imagine, the deadline for the grant is tomorrow. So we're working very quickly to see if it is possible to be able to submit for this grant. In 2012, the Department of Corrections was the recipient of the very same grant in the amount of $290,000, and it allowed us to create an advanced parole and probation officer academy, in which more than 90% of the POs across the state were able to participate. Training topics included case management strategies, evidence-based practices, gender-specific supervision, and how to effectively work with victims of crime. The Academy was a great success, and to date, the Bureau of Justice continues to use our model in training other states on how to implement training practices. In addition, our grant and what we did with it will be a featured presentation at the 2017 International Corrections and Prisons Association Conference in London, England later this year. Moving forward to today, this 2017 grant submission will allow DOC and community corrections agencies to continue the ongoing implementation of evidence-based practices within community supervision. Consider this as the next round of the advanced academies we did in 2012, this time specifically designed for supervisors, managers, and our lead workers within the field. The topics will range from improving basic competencies to building implementation and sustainability plans within our profession. This grant will allow leaders from both our rural and urban centers to attend these academies throughout the next 3 years at absolutely no cost to the county and no further cost to the state. The grant would cover all expenses related to training all of the supervisors within parole and probation. Our managers will be more equipped and trained to assess and address areas of need within their agencies. New practices and cultures will ensure momentum and focus are not lost. And as before, we'll have a research team to oversee our design and implementation, and we'll continually provide feedback and recommendation to our project. I'll close with saying that the saying in the field is that implementation and new strategies and supporting change lives or dies with your frontline supervisors. We want to increase the likelihood that the new and emerging techniques in our profession not only live, but that they thrive. And so with that, I thank you for your time, and I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Questions or discussion? Mr. Ball.
He's
not here. Oh, that's right. You're taking Mr. Ball's place.
Co-Chair Winters, Tamara Brickman for the Chief Financial Office, and we approve the request.
Miss Julie.
Madam Co-Chair, the Legislative Fiscal Office also recommends approval of the grant application request.
Can I get a recommendation? I'd like to get from the House.
Sure. Madam Chair.
Yes.
I would recommend that we accept all the reports that were given, and we encourage the I'm not even close to this, am I? Let's move the LFO recommendation on this grant.
To the full committee.
To the full committee. Always me.
Thank you, Rep. Huffman. Is there any further discussion? Any objection?
No. Thank you for your time.
I'm opening a public public hearing on House Bill 5031, the Oregon State Police. Now, Superintendent Hampton, please.
Thank you, Senator.
And that's not Mr. Ball either.
Chair Winters, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Travis Hampton. I have the honor of serving as the superintendent of the Oregon State Police. I'd like to start off with just giving a quick agency overview on some of the testimony you'll be hearing over the next 3 days. I'd like to just read into the record the Oregon State Police vision, mission, and value statement. This was refreshed at the end of last year with employee input from across section of the agency and was incorporated into a department five-year plan. The vision of the Oregon State Police is to provide premier public safety services. The mission, founded in 1931, the mission of the Oregon State Police is to serve the state of Oregon with a diverse workforce dedicated to the protection of people, property, and natural resources. Our values are honor, loyalty, dedication, compassion, and integrity. This is a quick look of the current Oregon State Police organizational chart depicting the assignments of respective bureaus of 1,266 FTE. You'll be hearing from these six bureaus over the next 3 days in detail and the men and women that work and comprise them. Some law enforcement hot topics facing not only Oregon State Police, but all law enforcement in Oregon. Just like to spend a little bit of time on that. Staffing, equipment, and racial profiling, use of force statistics. For staffing, you'll hear some challenges that the agency has across the department, including forensics and other service delivery entities. But I'd like to touch base on our patrol division staffing, the issue that keeps me up at night and that I am most concerned about. This slide depicts a date that will live on in infamy with the Oregon State Police, 1980, when we were moved from the gas tax to a general fund competition. You'll see since that time in 1980, licensed drivers have increased in Oregon 51%. The state's population has increased 52%, and the troopers on the road to protect Oregon's highways and interstates have decreased by 41%. These are general fund troopers, and I just want to make note that it does not include our other funded positions at the Oregon State University office or here at the Capitol. How do we rank nationally? At least we're better than Florida. You'll see that we are comparing troopers.
Sarah Steiner here.
I'm sorry. Superintendent Hampton, you pointed out that that red line there does not include the state troopers at the Capitol. I know we have increased staffing here. Who did we steal from?
Well, Senator Winters, Senator Snyder-Hayward, those are added positions that will be funded independent of our other operations. So we are not stealing from anybody at this time. We are adding positions.
Okay, good. I want to make sure of that because I would worry that we were leaving other areas less protected by having more troopers here. Not that we don't value them. We love having them here. But I just want to make sure we're not unprotecting or decreasing protection for other Oregonians.
Yes, and there are times when there's a maybe a contentious bill or a demonstration that might involve a larger police presence. We do bring troopers from all over the state there, but
sure.
This Capitol is the heart and lungs of the state trooper policing environment, so we're pretty proud of the role we play here, but no, we don't routinely deplete other places for the Capitol, though.
Thank you.
If we were to look at troopers per 1,000 citizen population, this is how we stack up nationally. We rank 48 of 49 state police highway patrol agencies. Hawaii, of course, does not have a state police comparable. This is a little bit of a busy slide. It's hard to read, but I just wanted to fit it all in there. If we were to compare Oregon's population roughly, our greatest comparable is number 15, Oklahoma. That has 3.9 million residents. You'll note if you can read it, they have 820 patrol troopers compared to Oregon's 330.
Just because the general public or those who are listening in can't see the slide that's up, but I believe that we're next to the bottom, with Florida being below us. Is that correct?
Yes, Senator, that's accurate.
And at one time in our history, when we were back in and before the passage of the measure that removed the state troopers from the highway fund, we were probably more up at the top of the scale someplace.
Yes, Senator Winters, we were to the high middle towards the top.
And so we have just declined from the 80s till today to where our trooper force is almost at the bottom.
Yes, Senator, that's accurate.
In fact, I should say at the bottom, because only one other state is less than we are. I just have to say that because I really support my troopers, and they keep our highways safe, and they do more than just our highways, and you'll hear more in that presentation, but for those who are listening.
Thank you, Senator. Just quickly, on a trooper per 1,000 scale, as the Senator mentioned, from 1980 to the present, this is the service gap that has widened with our staffing to the citizens of Oregon. It's another visual of the previous slide. And this next slide just depicts of our 33 patrol offices, once again, not including OSU or here at the Capitol. This shows our decline from 624 troopers in 1980 to 372 troopers that we see on the road today. Just looking around the table in the areas you represent, you can see the Portland metropolitan area, the old Beaverton office, where we had 32 troopers working in Washington County. We now have six. Portland, 68 troopers, down to 26. Salem, 48 troopers, down to 23. And the red offices depict offices that we've totally closed just because we no longer staff them. Of the offices depicted here, none of them cover 24 hours a day. And to have approximately half as many frontline service delivery workers delivering to the policing challenges compared to 1980. You can imagine the environment now with the population increase. This is before cell phones, before computers. These are the troopers delivering the service today. Not all bad, though. This is how, on the topic of equipment, this committee has been very good to us in the past to provide us the ability to leverage technology, equipment, and IT in our favor. These red dots depict the troopers that take their car home. We enjoy right now a 1-to-1 car ratio for our patrol troopers. This assists me and my agency, our agency, to embrace the mobile office platform where we don't need an office for our troopers to work. I could deploy these officers from all over the state at the time of emergency. They don't have to share a car. So if I route troopers to the Capitol or to Portland during the times of civil unrest, they don't take the car shared by the other member of their office. They work from the minute they leave their driveway to the second they get home, available for service calls after hours. Like a snow event like we're seeing now or the one we had last month, where you really have an all-hands-on-deck scenario. If all these troopers did not have their own cars to deploy them around the state, I'm not sure how we would get by, if not for the high level of cooperation that we have right now with our chiefs and sheriff's departments around the state.
Representative Sanchez.
So going back to your previous slide, I was just looking at the numbers here and wondering, how does Bend rate?
Yep, Bend.
What happened there?
Sure. Co-Chair Winters, Representative Sanchez. Bend, we do compensate for the population from 1980 through now has increased. We do have a patrol staffing model we deploy through the state that does consider calls for service, highway miles responsibility, safety corridors, case numbers pooled, and then when we deploy the troopers around the state based on the staffing model, there's a utility assigned in that ratio, and that what comprises our staffing. We also take into account the ability for sheriff's office partner agencies to deliver service in the area. Then with that, we do have some subjective application to our staffing. An office like Ben has a high concentration of special operations members or SWAT team or mobile response team. A lot of times you see those wind up being a half-time employee because of their other duties, and then we'll compensate that office to assign personnel there. We also have to consider if you have a canine assigned to one office, that an employee that might have a high technical requirement for training that are pulled off patrol schedules. So a lot of those factors play. This is the population of Bend. It's just very different from 1980 to the present, and it serves also as a region headquarters. Our state used to mirror ODOT with five command areas. We closed our Eastern Oregon office, command area, and our patrol base. So we have three bases of command for our department: Salem, Springfield, and now Bend. Bend services all of Central and Eastern Oregon from a command perspective. Thanks. Okay, on the other topic of racial profile and use of force, apologies to Representative Sanchez. He's heard this three times now, an hour ago at the latest.
Yes.
in a different committee. So Oregon State Police has been collecting enforcement data since August of 2000. Much of the components of the racial profiling bill working through a House Judiciary now, Oregon State Police complies with almost all of that as far as data collection. We've enjoyed a nice relationship with the Law Enforcement Contacts Committee at Portland State for many years. We used to collect this data via police radio through CAD clearance codes, computer-aided dispatch. We now collect this information through our mobile data terminals. So we collect race based on the officer's perception, gender, age through the date of birth, reason for contact, citation or warning. And we also document on all our enforcement contacts if the search is consensual, probable cause, incident to arrest. We also document what we find in those searches: nothing, guns, weapons, any other contraband. And this is a requirement for any warning, citation, arrest, traffic stop, fish and wildlife contact in the field, or pedestrian contact right now. On our use of force data, troopers are required to submit a written use of force notification on any force used to overcome physical resistance. So we don't start our force documentation at a high level. We start that anytime someone tries to pull away or passively resist, we have to put hands on to overcome that resistance. We document that in a written format. It's a multi-level chain of command review, and that chain of command review includes video evidence. All our patrol cars and patrol pickups are assigned in-car camera. Some of our officers do have a redundant body camera assigned to them, like a trooper at the Oregon State University office where they're on foot patrol or bike patrol, or fish and wildlife troopers that are away from their pickups. They do have that redundant camera system. Quite frankly, what I'd like to provide to all our officers, so we might see that request coming before you 2 years from now when hopefully budgets are a little bit better. But for now, we do have the cameras on most our contacts. We are one of four highway patrol agencies participating in the FBI National Use of Force Data Collection Pilot Project. The FBI has interest in establishing a national database for use of force, much like Oregon is trying to do with our traffic stop data. And we voluntarily participate in that pilot now, along with Georgia, New Jersey, and Washington State. We review our data quarterly for stop and search data. Annually review stop, search, and use of force data, and we submit a biennial report of our stop, search, use of force, and racial profiling complaints, which include tort claims. This is by no means inclusive of the type of data reports we produce. It's just a quick snapshot as an example of our traffic stop data from last year. We had 211,787 stops. And we can compare our traffic stops to the census data for Oregon. It is not ideal. It is imperfect, but that is the best we have, considering about 26% of OSP's enforcement contacts are not even Oregon residents. Are their residents traveling through our state's highways and interstate system. The blue line will depict the Oregon census demographic, and the red line will depict the stop data in comparison. OSP has 12 key performance measures. You'll be hearing about these in detail over the next few days. I'd like to speak to the yellow and red KPMs. Traffic lane clearance rate corresponds to the fatal crash reduction. OSP has a common goal with the Oregon Department of Transportation that we clear lane blocking traffic crashes within 90 minutes. Oregon is unfortunately in our into our third year, ending 2016 with our third double-digit increase in fatal crashes. So that corresponds with our ability to clear lanes in the desired amount of time. And of course, our staffing has a lot to do with that, having the resources to put into play. Customer satisfaction and our forensics turnaround
Senator
time.
Senator Steiner here.
I'm sorry, Senator.
Thank you. No, it's fine. How much increase in fatal crashes?
Chair Winters, Senator Steiner Haywood, we are in our 2016, ended our third year of double-digit percentage fatal crashes.
So what does that mean in terms of numbers? If you don't have it off the top of your head, that's fine, Superintendent. But I mean, that's really disconcerting, and I'd love to know some of your thoughts about why that is. We're supposed to be getting safer, and is it all distracted driving? Do we see an increase in DUII?
Yeah, Chair Winters, Senator Steiner here. We do have a pretty extensive patrol presentation that might speak to
okay,
the numbers
great.
And answer your question.
Thank you very much. I'll leave
but
it.
But if I had the answer to that question, I would probably retire and go on a professional speaking tour. I don't have the answer. We have the what we call the three E's: engineering, enforcement, and education. We don't have the enforcement, quite frankly, that there is no reasonable expectation in Oregon that a state trooper will stop you on Oregon's highways. We're just not out there as much as we should be. But distracted driving, big player. We have, we employ evidence-based policing on our fatal traffic enforcement, so we know the causation factors. It makes up our Fatal Five acronym is SOLID: speed, occupant safety, lane usage, impaired driving, distracted driving. All those five are at play. The distracted driving, I think we probably underestimate how much of a role that plays. If you see our press releases, car ran off the road, we don't know why, under investigation. And so we have the single vehicle off in the tree. Speed definitely plays a part, the lane usage, but people cannot get off their cell phone devices. And there's a lot of concepts going through the Capitol right now, I know, but that is a big contributor, and our ability to meet the demand, the public safety demand, to stop people that are violating the law.
Thank you.
It goes back to those numbers that we talked about early on, and the number of the state police force in comparison to 80 to today.
Mm-hmm. And you'll hear about a little bit about forensic turnaround time and customer satisfaction, the ability of our crime labs to meet the crushing demand of forensics testing in the state of Oregon. And Captain Samuel will detail the red KPM of hunter and angler interaction. We now have most, if not all, of our vacancies filled in Fish and Wildlife, but just that's a service delivery challenge, having enough Fish and Wildlife troopers in the field to meet our desired goal on hunter-angler interaction. This is a quick snapshot of the 2017-19 governor's recommended budget. You can see we are heavily reliant on general fund, also utilizing lottery, other funds, and federal funds. This is a busy slide, I apologize, but this is just to enter into the record the governor's recommended budget, all funds by division. You can see the lion's share of our budget is still patrol division. And once again, by general fund, you note once on this slide even better illustrates how dependent on general fund our patrol division is and some of our staffing challenges. In the 2017-19 governor's budget, cost-saving measures closes the Pendleton Forensics Lab, cancels the relocation of the Springfield Patrol Office and Crime Lab, reduces our drug enforcement section by 19 of our 27 drug enforcement detectives, essentially ending OSP's involvement in statewide drug team participation, and postpones the purchase of the 33 new patrol cars to maintain our one-to-one capability.
Senator Frederick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am particularly interested, I know you're going to go into this a little, I hope, in detail regarding the Pendleton Forensics Lab and the drug enforcement. That's what we heard a lot about during the road trip that we just came back from the Ways and Means Committee. A lot of discussion about that. So if you keep that in mind, then I'd like to hear more about those two areas and the impact that you see.
Chair Winters, Senator Frederick, yeah, we have a great deal of detail on the impacts to service delivery later in the presentation.
Great. Thank you.
And I probably didn't elaborate enough earlier when I was showing the map of where troopers take home the cars. But on the mobile office platform, we have been able to close those offices to save rent. If troopers have their own vehicle, they have their own in-car cameras, the MDTs, mobile data terminals, their own printers in their vehicles, their own weapons. So not having to share equipment is really maximized and leveraged that by leveraging that technology has enabled us to provide the service that's expected of us on Oregon's highways. So on this postponing the purchase of the 33 new patrol vehicles, that will impact us to a degree. And 50% general and ladder fund reduction list. Much of this is realized in the governor's recommended budget down to the criminal justice ID service partial shift to other fund. And then we get into reductions in our Fish and Wildlife Division personnel. OSP is pretty lean when it comes to cuts, and so we get down to the bone pretty quick, and we get right into people. Proposed policy option packages, you'll hear about these in great deal. POP 100, the LEDS 2020 crime bee replacement. The speaker right after me will detail that. That's a replacement of LEDS files, that hot files that Oregon State Police maintains. POP 108 is a increase in FTE to combat the backlog of safe kits and forensics. POP 119 deals with Fish and Wildlife Division. POP 116 is for the addition of two troopers at our Oregon State University office, one of those dedicated to sexual assault. And POP 111 deals with position authority in the State Fire Marshal's office.
Yes, Representative Barker.
So with the troopers at OSU and one doing sex assault, I'm hoping that that means that the college won't be hiding that anymore, that the police will be investigating those sexual assaults. In the past, you know, those things just seem to disappear, and I'm encouraged by hearing that one of those officers will be working that.
Yeah, Senator Winters, Representative Barker, I've only met in person with the university one time on this topic. It's my past job when I was a field operations major, and they had a great deal of interest on not only preventing through education, but through investigative efforts to bring offenders to justice at the university with our unique relationship there.
Good. Well, thank you.
Whoops. The department's proposed legislative concepts, patrol, has one, House Bill 2323, which would extend the exemption of hour limitation to retired troopers working at revenue, the governor's residence, and judicial, much like the troopers working here in the Capitol. Fish and Wildlife has a bill, House Bill 2324, that deals with offensive littering, ability to cite as a violation, not just a crime. Senate Bill 76 deals with ORS 463 and the Oregon State Athletic Commission. Some language there. Senate Bill 77 and 78 deal with sex offender registration and SORNA compliance. And State Medical Examiner, House Bill 2322 cleans up some language and titles in the State Medical Examiner ORS 146. Here's a list depicting our long-term vacancies, which you'll hear a little bit more about in the presentation. Positions vacant longer than 12 months, we have 14. Positions vacant longer between 7 and 11 months, 17, to bring an agency total of 31. About half of those are sworn staff in our patrol division. You'll see how heavily dependent we are on general fund. Quite frankly, I have to hold vacancies to keep the lights on other parts of the department during lean times, and that's what we find ourselves doing. Then, of course, then we compete for academy class time at DPSST. We realize about 2 to 3 sworn retirements per month, and keeping up with attrition and recruiting has been a challenge for us.
Superintendent, are you still having the issue of losing some of your troopers to some of the cities and counties?
Senator Winters,
because of wage differentials?
Senator Winters, after the pay compression issue was the law was passed, where the comparables for OSP are cities and county departments in Oregon, not just highway patrols at neighboring states. We have not seen that problem like we used to. In fact, we have a lot of
good
other agencies that look for us to employment now.
The other one I want to go back to, and that's the issue of the 33 vehicles and whether or not also you've been able to upgrade and equip all the other vehicles, which has, you know, been something that the other good rep and I and others have been working on for several years to make certain that you have what you need in the vehicles that are out there on the road.
Yeah, Senator Winters, we went from 0 to 60 through this effort to this committee. I know you had a lot to do with that personally, but we came out of the Stone Age with our equipment. We were a revolver and old car department, and so we now enjoy buying all-wheel drive vehicles to patrol in the winter passes. The weapons are, to keep the troopers safe, the protective equipment, the vest, the rifle plates, the mobile data terminals, the radars, the printers in the cars.
Communication systems.
The list goes on and on. And quite frankly, if not for the equipment, I think we would fall flat on our face with the number of troopers we have, if not for the equipment to sustain us through some of these leaner times. So thank you.
Just want to make certain that you're getting what you need.
We are. We may not get what we want, but we get what we need.
It's a lyric there somewhere.
Our book.
Members of the committee, it is an honor to appear before you. I know these are lean times, and that's why I say that in jest and really a dose of seriousness. So we have the respective division and section heads will come up now and detail what I just went through very quickly. And if there's no questions, we'll move along.
Questions?
Thanks.
Thank you.
That's fine. Let's get out of the way. Yeah. Major Worthy?
Co-Chair Winters, members of the committee, my name is Tom Worthy. I'm a major with the Oregon State Police. I am over the Public Safety Services Bureau, an organization which I'm very proud of. Seated to my left is Patricia Whitfield, who is our Director of CJIS Services, Criminal Justice Information Services at OSP, and she'll have a part of this presentation about our CJIS services at OSP. I'm here to speak to you today about these items. Within the Bureau, we have the Northern and Southern Command Center. Those are our dispatch centers, which provide operational readiness for our patrol troopers 365 days a year around the clock. That's direct service delivery and assigning troopers to calls as they come in from the public. Our central records section, which manages all manner of police records, police operational records within the department. A program, the school safety tip line, which some of you are probably familiar with, and I'll talk more about that later. Also, our information technology section, which enables the department to have data and present some of the programs that you'll see later and that you've already heard about so far. Our criminal justice information systems, which Patricia will speak to you about, and our LEDS 2020 or CrimeView replacement project, which is a large project that's in flight right now, and we're happy to update you about that as well. As I mentioned, the Oregon State Police maintains two command centers, the Northern Command Center here in Salem and the Southern Command Center in Central Point. These are our dispatch centers that get the troopers to the calls for service. They intake calls for service from the public and other public safety partners and make sure that those are dispatched out in a timely fashion to our troopers in the field. In 2016, they handled over 400,000 events or calls for service. Notably in our command centers, we have a project that's just completing now, which is a dispatch console upgrade that manages the phones and radios as they come into the center and makes our dispatchers more efficient. You could imagine that oftentimes there's a need for a recording of a call or a radio dispatch. That's the application that does that, as well as managing those calls as they come into the center. So we're happy that that project is performing well. We also, by having these two centers and the new radio console system, we have provided the department with what we call command failover, meaning that if our Southern Oregon Command Center is a fiber line gets cut by a backhoe or somebody planting a tomato plant, we'll have the Northern Command Center can pick up that work and vice versa as well. So we're happy in that regard as well. Also, our CAD system, which we spoke to you about several times in the past, was upgraded. And as you know, software applications progress quickly in today's day and age. And that is in a upgrade phase right now with the vendor to bring it up to the most modern version of that application. Our next section in the Bureau is our central records section. Central Records averages over 8,000 records requests per year, all types of records requests from public to other criminal justice partners. They're split almost evenly down the middle. They have, in this past year, adopted and implemented Executive Order 1606, which is the statewide public records management policy, and we were happy to have input into that. We also manage other functions of the department, such as seals and expungements, working with court records, crime reporting, and then retention of records and disposing of them when the retention schedule is up. Our budget for the support services program area for dispatch centers is almost $19 million, and central records is just over $2 million, and that's a portion of a greater toll in the total in the support services area. I mentioned a program that we're very proud of at the department, the School Safety Tip Line, which was created by House Bill 4075 in the 2016 short session. And it was launched and is live now, January 31st of 2017. And we have 153 schools enrolled. We went through a lengthy vendor selection process, so it is an outsourced vendor application, which we piloted with both Intermountain School District and Hermiston Educational School Service District as well in North Central Oregon. We reached out to the students and the staff and the parents out there and asked them to have input both in how the application works and what they can expect there, as well as the marketing and branding, to make sure that it really appealed to our students in the field and in the rest of the state. The program accepts tips relating to school safety, any manner of school safety, and they can be submitted via a web page, electronic mail, text message, a mobile application, or they can make a call to a call center that will answer the phone any time of the day or night, any day of the year. The contract with that vendor is good through 2021. We're proud of the progress in that regard. Next.
Senator Frederickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can you go back to that previous slide? What are the primary tips that you're getting at this particular point? What's the most the category that you're dealing with most?
So it's a wide range of tips, or Co-Chair Winters, Senator Frederick, it's a wide range of tips from bullying to self-harm. It's really the whole gamut of it. Certainly most of the tips that we see are lowly classified tips. They're very, somebody got pushed in the hallway type of thing. And then very rarely have we seen the top-level tips that require immediate response, but we have in the past.
Follow-up. What I'm just curious about what you're getting in terms of the response from the local school, the local law enforcement in that particular area, because I'm sure you're not going out to talk with everyone. So what kind of response are you getting there? How have they been reacting?
Co-Chair Winters, Senator Frederick, the schools are embracing of this program. They see the value. The individual principals and the students certainly do. It's a matter of they have policies and practices on their side of what to do when they receive tips, and those are coming into place now. So many of the school districts are concerned that they always have the correct response and the correct people are notified, and so lead them to a good solution rather than force them to it type of a situation. And schools are excited about this. They're coming our direction, but there's more work to be done there, no doubt.
One more follow-up. Following the Thurston incident in 1998, mm-hmm. a number of school districts put together something like this. Is this layered on top of it, or did those things drop off? How would you describe where you fit within that whole system?
Sure. Co-Chair Winters, Senator Frederick, there was at one time a State of Oregon school safety tip line that was mm-hmm. run through the Department of Justice, I believe. That failed to fund several years after it launched, and it never really took root. It was planted, and it didn't take off. So there are a number of school safety tip lines out there that are contracted. They're varying levels of success, and there's also varying levels of adoption. We see this as the one thing that can work for all of the school districts out there, and be a real positive for Oregon. So it's a matter of us getting to the schools, showing them the value, and helping them through those processes. And this is a best practice for what your process would look like on your end.
I'd like to get a little bit more about that, so I won't get in the way of this now, but I just wanted to let you know I'd like to hear more about this. Thank you.
Yes, sir. Our information technology at the Oregon State Police, we have three core principles with which we view all of our projects that are proposed. Our aim in information technology is to modernize, standardize, and engage and enable. I'll tell you a little bit more about what we mean by those. By modernize, OSP information technology aims to bring OSP up to current industry standards, and that's an important connection to the LEDS 2020 project that I'll talk about here in a little while. And we want to enhance our security posture against cyber attacks. As we know from other experience within the state, that is a real and ongoing threat to our operation. By standardize, we mean consistent operations statewide. As a statewide entity, it's important for us to do things and manage our operations the same in LeGrand or Central Point or Bend or wherever we happen to be, and then also maximize the use of existing systems. If we have one system that will serve two purposes, that's far better than having two systems. It's less to maintain, it's less to upgrade, and it's less to pay for. So every opportunity that we have to use one system for multiple solutions, we will take. And then engage and enable, which means to connect systems both internally and externally, following data and events through their life cycle. While they might originate in one system and ultimately land in another, we want to be able to track data as it passes between our systems, and then also share that data with our key partners and stakeholders. It's not just good enough to have it. You have to be able to get your hands on it, use it, manipulate it, and understand what it means. And then also use that information internally to make data-driven public safety, staffing, and department metrics decisions, and to keep the state of Oregon as safe as we can using the information that we have already. OSP IT also is in compliance with Executive Order 1613 for IT security enhancement. We're working with the State Office of the CIO and also have contributed to the information resource management plan with our strategic technology officer. Here's our budget slide for IT. You can see that our general fund is slightly more than $8 million, and our other funds is just over $2 million for this service section. And now I turn it over to Patricia Whitfield to speak about Oregon Criminal Justice Information Systems.
Co-Chair Winters, members of the committee, Tricia Whitfield. The Criminal Justice Information Services Division is Oregon's sole source repository for statewide criminal offender information and the exchange of that information between law enforcement criminal justice agencies nationwide. While agencies typically have their own local database or record systems, having one central data bank collectively for law enforcement to use throughout the state helps keep citizens and officers safe. CJIS Division has 100 staff working in six main program areas: the computerized criminal history records unit, our automated biometric identification system where we process fingerprints, palm prints, and mugshot photos from arrests; applicant and regulatory background checks; law enforcement data system programs where we are responsible to train users statewide and audit those users in their use of the system and the data, as well as uniform crime reporting. We also have the firearms InstaCheck system and the National InstaCheck system NICS Records Improvement Program grant. It's a mouthful. CJIS Division priorities. We need to ensure that criminal justice partners have uninterrupted access to law enforcement systems and data 24 hours, 7 days a week. The criminal history file alone in the last 12 months was accessed by our partners and agencies over 3.3 million times. And all records within the law enforcement data system in the last 12 months over 30 million times. It's important, and a priority for us is that we provide real-time reporting of complete and accurate records, specifically arrest and disposition records. We received over 140,000 arrest fingerprint cards for the repository last year and over 30,000 dispositions from the courts. I mentioned earlier it's important and it's an obligation that we provide training to users throughout the state as well as audit. We certified over 15,000 users, certified and recertified, and we did 164 audits. Timely applicant and firearms background checks are very important. Many of you hear about those. We did over 120,000 fingerprint regulatory checks for teachers, school bus drivers, those types of regulatory programs, and 302,000 firearms background checks. It's also important that we coordinate with our criminal justice partners. Major mentioned standards, not only within our department, but statewide and even nationwide. The better our data is, the better it is to help provide public safety services. The division's operational efficiencies and successes are largely realized when we have a continuous review of our programs, and we do that and have been able to consolidate internal workflows and processes, technology implementation whenever possible, system enhancements and refresh so that we are able to keep on top of the demand for services. CJIS Division has one published key performance measure, and that is depicted in the orange and the blue on this chart. It's a little bit busy, but our KPM is the average turnaround time for an arrest fingerprint card when it is sent to us manually through the mail. And we do have
Senator Steiner here.
Yes. Thank you so much. One of the things that stunned me when I visited, I want to say Coffee Creek, actually, a while ago, was to realize how many of our local law enforcement agencies are still on manual fingerprint systems. Can you talk a little bit more about how you're working, if you're able to work with local law enforcement counties or city law enforcement about updating the fingerprint systems? Because that's got to be a barrier to solving crime and keeping track of folks and that we're supposed to keep track of. I just need a little education. And if it's not appropriate here, I'm happy to take it offline.
Certainly, I can give you a high-level view of that. Chair Winters, Senator Steiner, Hayward, we received about 3,400 manual fingerprint cards last year. That's about 2.5% of our total volume of criminal arrest cards. And most of the agencies are serviced, if you will, through the jails. The county jails will have a live scan device, and that's how they transmit the majority of the fingerprints. But there are some cases where local agencies might choose to have their own live scan. They're costly to maintain, but they also might need to fingerprint folks that maybe aren't able to go to the jail for one reason or another, so that will contribute to those. There are grant funds that are available that we provide information and resources to. Live scan technology is how is best relayed to us, and that's the other part of the chart in the green kind of candy stripe that you see. Our turnaround for manual cards, that's from the point that we receive it, the point that we've positively identified the fingerprints and posted to the criminal history, the target is 4 days on that. If it's an automated card, our target is 2 hours. So the difference between 2 hours and 4 days, of course, is huge. So we do keep track of those agencies that submit to us manually and do what we can to help them to make the transition.
But I guess the short answer is that the local jurisdiction, it's their responsibility of whatever methodology that they use.
That's correct.
Right. Thank you.
The see, just the vision budget, as you will see, is all funds, $27.3 million, and a large portion of that is other funds. We do charge a fee for many of the services that we perform, and revenue generated is used to support all of our programs. Some of our budget drivers include infrastructure and technology, specifically hardware, software, and in some cases network charges. Customer needs for enhanced services. Everyone wants something better, faster, more data available. Policy and law changes. If there are changes that affect our partner agencies or the services that we provide, that certainly is a budget factor for us. And then our firearms and check staffing. Keeping up with that demand has been quite a challenge.
And Senator Winters and members of the committee, I'll take it home from here. Our last subject of this presentation is our LEDS 2020 project, which came to life being known as the CrimeView Replacement Project. CrimeView is our old application, so we want to begin to moniker this as the future state, which is LEDS 2020. The question about this project might be, why is it important and what is it? LEDS 2020 is a project in three phases. Our current LEDS system is Oregon's only criminal history repository, our very basic record of who got arrested for what was the outcome. So it's core really to the entire criminal justice system is one leg of this. A second leg is the message switch.
Excuse me, what year was that initiated, you recall?
What year was the project initiated?
LEDS.
2014 is when we started this CrimeView replacement project.
But what was the system before you started this project?
Senator Winters, it was CrimeView was the name of the database. It's approximately 20 years old.
That's where I was going.
Yeah, and we're going to come to that as well. So the second leg of this project is the message switch. That's our electronic message brokering system that connects us with the rest of the United States and the rest of the world, really, through our connection with Interpol. And that's used not all of these systems used not just by OSP, but all criminal justice in Oregon, and also 21 what we call hot files or records such as wanted persons, stolen property, or protection orders, or other things that police would be interested in or others when contacting people. So the value of the system can't be overstated. Ms. Whitfield mentioned that our criminal history database was accessed over 3.3 million times last year, and our message switch, which will be replaced a couple of months ago, issued its 1 billionth transaction. Our project purpose for the LEDS 2020 project is to sustain the existing public safety information services that are in place now. We don't want to be disruptive. We want to make things better, not worse, and ensure access to public safety data around the clock. This is where you were wondering about, ma'am. It's nearly 20-year-old system, and this also, by replacing the system, will modernize it and allow us to adapt to new FBI requirements that come out periodically for us, actually regularly. We hope that the outcome of the LEDS 2020 project will be to achieve a near 100% uptime. These really aren't systems that we can afford to take down or have go down, much worse. As well as increased functionality for the system and maximize the usability to agency customers, as well as to provide a user interface that's common across law enforcement in Oregon and criminal justice. We brought with us a one-page overview of the project. Since it's a very large, very complex systems replacement project, we've widely distributed this one-pager, and we'll leave copies of this over here. Sometimes it takes a little time to wrap your head around something like this. This is a project that's in flight. We did put forth Policy Option Package 100 that the superintendent mentioned, which is asking for expenditure authority for the 17-19 biennium. This project, we did kick it off in May 2014, and we only recently signed a contract with a software solution vendor, so it's been a lot of planning, but planning now makes success later. And we do have a targeted completion date of October 2020. As this is Ways and Means, you have to be thinking how much. We estimate now that it'll be a $10.3 million project, and that does exclude hosting charges. We're working with our partner state agencies, the strategic technology officers, as well as the legislative fiscal office in pursuit of this project. We've been open and collaborative throughout, and we intend to continue to do that. We know that there are challenges ahead in this project, and we're doing everything we can on the front end to alleviate those. So that really brings me to the end of our presentation for the Public Safety Services Bureau of the Oregon State Police. I thank you for your attention. We are open for any questions if you have any.
Questions? Thank you very much for your presentation.
Okay. Excuse my bouncing around. Good afternoon, Chair Winters and committee members. For the record, my name is Teresa Bloom, and I am captain of the Oregon State Police Patrol Division. I am here today to give you an overview of the division, and we'll be happy to answer any questions that you may have. The Patrol Division provides uniform police services throughout the state with the primary responsibility of patrolling over 6,400 miles of rural and interstate highways. We also protect state property as well as combined 254 rest areas and state parks. Our priorities for the division are traffic enforcement, apprehension of persons involved in criminal activity, crash investigation, response to calls for service, and in fact, in 2016, our division responded to just over 116,000 calls for service. We also render aid to citizens in need, and in 2016, we had just over 29,000 motorist assists and received over 49,000 driving complaints from the public. We also provide assistance to other law enforcement agencies. Our dispatch recorded that in 2016, there were over 18,000 outside law enforcement agency assists performed by the Oregon State Police.
Captain, do you have the assist data broken out by counties?
Chair Winters, I do not have that data with me today, but I can get back with you.
Thank you.
We accomplish these priorities not only through traditional traffic enforcement, but also through all the programs within the division and that work in and support the field. As you can see, we have multiple programs within the division that not only support our efforts throughout the state, but also augment, enhance, and support our local law enforcement agencies where needed. Some of those essential programs are our crash reconstruction unit, our SWAT team, our mobile response team, our drug recognition experts, our fixed unit, and of course our canine unit, which I'd like to highlight as an operational success on the next slide.
I'm chuckling because she knew I was going to ask questions about canine.
And I have a picture for you, Chair Winters, of one of our dogs. In 2015, our canine unit, which is one of the greatest assets we have for combating illegal traffic and controlled substances, had just over 240 canine applications. Of those over 240 applications, the unit seized over 59 pounds of cocaine, 221 pounds of methamphetamine, 75 pounds of heroin, and 53 pounds of marijuana.
With our changes and the passage of the recreational law for marijuana, and what impact or what implications will that be for now for our canine dogs that were trained, probably in identification of all of the various drugs? So,
Chair Winters, I can speak to that in that our current makeup of our canine units are all changed over to just three older dogs. So we have no further changes that we need to make. And we'll proceed with that moving forward. We have 9 authorized positions in the unit. Currently, there are 7 handlers and canines working across the state in cities such as Roseburg, Salem, Springfield, Bend,
Lakeview, the Dalles, and Central Point area commands. There is also one handler identified in the Klamath Falls area who is waiting to attend training and receive his canine partner. We are hoping to identify the ninth handler in the near future who will be stationed out in Eastern Oregon.
That was going to be my question. Thank you.
Oh, Eastern Oregon.
Yes, exactly.
This unit is not only an asset to our division and the agency, but also supports and assists Oregon communities and law enforcement partners who do not possess the resources to deploy drug canine dogs. Another noteworthy success would be the deployment of our 40 unmarked patrol cars focused on OSP's Fatal Five. You will hear me use the Fatal Five term multiple times in this presentation. In cooperation with ODOT, the patrol division has identified five major categories of driving behavior that contributes to fatal or serious injury crashes. OSP's Fatal Five is comprised of speed, occupant safety, lane safety, impaired driving, and distracted driving. As you will see on the graph, we have only highlighted one of our Fatal Five, which is distracted driving. As I know most of you are aware, over the past few years, traffic fatalities have spiked. One of those causes is distracted driving. Enforcing laws involving handheld electronic devices is very difficult in a marked police vehicle, and as such, we wanted to record those specific efforts. According to the most recent data compiled comparing our distracted driving enforcement actions since the rollout of our unmarked vehicles in February of 2016, we have seen a 16% increase in traffic citations and warnings related to distracted driving. Regarding the decrease you see on the graph during the winter months, it is worth noting that during that time period, we saw a 66% increase in the number of crashes we responded to, which in turn affect our troopers' ability to do proactive patrolling. And as expected, we also saw a 36% decrease in the number of routine contacts that result in warnings and citations such as distracted driving. So you'll see that kind of ebb and flow based on the winter months really are kind of heavy on those crashes. So,
Madam Chair?
Senator Steiner Hayward.
Thank you. Just out of curiosity, how bad was the crash? Were the crash numbers this year compared to other years? I mean, this was one heck of the winter along the I-5 corridor.
Oh, yes. Chair Winters and Senator Steiner Hayward, I will get to that when I on one of my KPMs,
no,
if that's okay.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. In addition, our department business and operations analyst developed and continues to manage what we call the Fatal Five dashboard. And you'll see this is just a snapshot of what that looks like for our troopers and sergeants and commanders around the state. This was developed in an effort to assist region and area commanders with strategically planning their patrol efforts around the state. The dashboard displays detailed information in a format that is interactive for them. It identifies trends in driver behaviors, our enforcement actions, and the data and time of our activities for each office around the state. At the beginning of each month, I review all the dashboards statewide and prepare and distribute the information to the area, region, and bureau commanders, along with the most recent daily traffic toll from ODOT in an effort to highlight outstanding work on the part of our troopers and also to assist with their planning efforts for the upcoming month. And I know that's a very busy slide, but it's just a snapshot of that. They can click and manipulate it and for time of day, day of the week, the month, which office they're in, a highway, a state highway, a road, and to give them their numbers. Moving on to our key performance measures, the first KPM specifically deals with the goal of reducing fatal crashes by 25% over a 10-year period. The baseline is based on an average between 2008 and 2012 fatal crashes that comes out to be 134, which you can see on the graph there. So a 25% reduction over 10 years would be 101 fatal crashes by 2022. One other thing that this KPM will do is allow us to examine the effectiveness of our efforts towards evidence-based driving behaviors that leads to fatal crashes, and as I previously noted from the last slide regarding our Fatal Five dashboard. Of course, you can see that the fatal crash numbers have risen instead of decreasing in 2014, with 149 reported crashes that resulted in a fatality on OSP areas of responsibility. I have also received preliminary data from ODOT for 2015, which shows an additional increase to 161. But the official crash data will not be available until later this year, so that is just a preliminary number.
Can, I'm assuming that you can break those down based on the location of those fatalities, whether it's I-5, whether it's 20, 26, or, you know, just where the location is.
Chair Winters, we would be able to do that, yes. The Patrol Services Division continues to focus on our primary role, which is the enforcement of driving behaviors that are known to contribute to fatal crashes. In addition, we will continue to work diligently with ODOT and other partners on engineering and education efforts aimed at reducing crashes. And to address some of the questions that Senator Steiner Hayward had for the superintendent earlier, there are some variables that affect the crash rates outside. We feel the control of OSP's enforcement, education, engineering, and emergency medical services efforts. Some of those factors include economy, adverse weather conditions, number of licensed drivers in Oregon, and then also the change in the annual fuel, because we've seen a drop in fuel prices, which then in turn people tend to drive more. And then shortfalls in the Oregon's general fund coupled with normal attrition can also impact the ability for the department to meet our targets in the future for this.
Senator Steiner-Hewitt.
Thank you. It does that. Your point about the population, the number of licensed drivers, does bring up an interesting question. It's great to think about reducing the number of crashes, but one of the questions is, you know, fatal crashes per 1,000 licensed drivers, or however you would do the stat, because, I mean, in reality, that would, if achieving that goal would mean not only decreasing the number, but dramatically decreasing the number per licensed driver, given the way our population is growing. Is that correct?
Chair Winters, Senator Steiner.
It's okay,
Steiner.
Don't worry about it. I know you want. I know. I have one of the most complicated names. It's okay.
I do understand what you're saying, and I think that would be something that we should look at for the future.
Be interesting thinking about that a little.
And just to tag along, because the population increase and growth, also, you've got in migration. And one of the things I've noted in Salem, behaviors that may not be the same behaviors of drivers who, like the chronologically advantaged person like myself, who have been out here, you know, for years and knowing that I can turn right in certain instances and where the other I cannot, you know, and so what may be applicable, and I don't think all of the all of the driving requirements are the same across this country, you know, particularly where you have one ways and two ways and some of those, and I don't know how much of the driving behavior when you're talking in migration, and I've noticed in Salem, you know, for example, you know, some drivers that I would have loved to have stopped and said, we don't do that in Oregon. Mm-hmm. You don't have to answer that. That's rhetorical.
Okay, so moving on. I'll now move on to our second key performance measure. This KPM was adopted during the 2015 legislative session. OSP partnered with ODOT, fire rescue personnel, and the towing industry to reduce the clearance times where there's lane blockage due to a crash. The continued goal of this measure is to have 80% of lane blocking crashes cleared within 90 minutes. This goal was set by a mutual agreement between OSP and ODOT on highways where OSP is the primary responsibility. We feel this goal will be accomplished by OSP continuing to focus on reducing the number of lane blocking incidents through enforcement of driving behaviors that lead to crashes such as our Fatal Five. In addition, we feel this goal can be achieved through education of personnel and stakeholders by way of traffic incident management training, which we refer to as TIM, and the implementation of the TIM principles, which are really about improved efficiency through cooperation and coordination with all emergency responders.
Representative Barker.
Captain, so Back in 1970, a few years back, when I patrolled I-5 up the road a piece, the policy at that time was that unless it was a fatal accident, we had tow trucks just drag everything off the side and we'd open the freeway right away. And I notice now it seems like it takes forever, a couple lanes blocked and everything. And on fatal accidents, we would, you know, hold it and do all the measurements and all that, pretty primitive in those days. But so for just a regular bad accident that nobody's, you know, doesn't look like a fatal, why are we holding the freeway closed like that for so long?
Chair Winters, Representative Barker, I think it really does fall to a case-by-case basis and is left upon the trooper to make that decision when responding based on the information that he's receiving from dispatch. So if there's any indication that there is an injury or something that we would need to map the scene or ensure that we understand how the crash occurred prior, because once they remove the vehicles and take them, it's a little harder for the troop to put them back together. So I think that's what you're seeing.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. I'd also like to point out that OSP has trained all of its troopers in traffic incident management, and we continue to participate around the state with our partners in furthering educational efforts. Although the graph shows that we had a decrease in the clearance rate, we believe a contributing factor for this is the increase in fatal crashes we have responded to. Fatal crashes can oftentimes result in felony criminal charges and require an in-depth investigation with extended time spent on scene. We continue to work with our partners, and last year we were awarded grant funding through ODOT to purchase new and improved technology in the form of robotic total measuring stations to assist with our crash reconstructionists with their investigations. And that should, over time, once they get up to speed on the new technology and use it to its full capacity, should reduce the time on scene. Our last KPM details the number of traffic stops that resulted in arrest or criminal citation. A primary objective of the patrol division in support of the agency's mission is to promote transportation safety on Oregon's highways. This is accomplished through high-frequency contacts, which include violations of traffic offenses, assisting motorists, and any other law enforcement encounters. Crimes of many types have a transportation component, which may come to the attention of a trooper while on active patrol. This is a philosophy within the patrol division to disrupt and dismantle all forms of criminal activity occurring on Oregon state and interstate highways. Basically, we call it looking beyond the ticket. A couple of examples are detection of weapons violations, identity theft, apprehension of fugitives and felons, narcotics traffickers, and stolen vehicles and property. The continual goal of this measure is to have 0.8% of all traffic stops resulting in arrest and criminal citation. The target percentage was determined by increasing the 2013 arrests and criminal citations by 10% and dividing that result by the total number of routine contacts for 2013. The reason for using 2013 data was the fact that we upgraded to a new CAD system, computer-aided dispatch, that year in 2013, which collects data in a different way than our old system did. So probably the best example would be prior to 2013, our system, if a trooper made a traffic stop and charged the driver with three crimes, the system would then attach three different numbers and almost count it as three separate stops, whereas the new system collects the data and it will record it as one traffic stop with three criminal charges. So basically the old system was kind of inflating the numbers, which is why you see a huge difference between 2012 and 2013. As you can also see on the graph, the department has exceeded our target. In 2015, there were over 198,000 total routine contacts, and out of those stops, there were over 2,800 enforcement contacts that resulted in an arrest or criminal citation. This number does not include traffic crimes such as DUI or reckless driving. Continued success in achieving the goal for this measure will be based on efforts to hire additional qualified troopers. It will also depend on the efforts the agency has and will continue to place on enhanced training to improve skills at detecting criminal activity during routine contacts and the department's ability to continue to provide supportive resources such as narcotic canines. Factors that could negatively affect this KPM are the ability for proactive patrol time, availability of cover officer or canine, tenure and experience, and our trooper strength. Lastly, you can see here the 2017-2019 governor's budget, proposed budget for the patrol division, which is just over $159 million, with 91% general fund, 9% other funds, and that would be things such as OSU and our Capitol Mall patrol office, and less than 1% that come from federal funds associated with contracts related to grants such as SPEED and Dewey Enforcement. Some of our budget drivers are fuel costs, recruit schools, and vacancies. To give you an example of the struggles we face with regards to attrition, as the superintendent previously mentioned in his presentation, we lose nearly 3 troopers agency-wide each month, and we have done so for many years. It is important to note that no matter what division the loss comes from, it will almost always affect the patrol division, as the troopers who will fill the vacancies, even in the specialty positions, more likely than not will always come from patrol. Other drivers are unforeseen and complex incidents, such as SWAT and mobile response team callouts like Harney County or the demonstrations in Portland. The Harney County refuge takeover alone required approximately 180 employees from around the state to respond at some point during the event, with 8,700 hours of straight time, 9,400 overtime hours, with a total cost of $1.25 million. We also respond to natural disasters and or extreme weather conditions, like we experienced in January of this year.
Captain, what did Portland cost us?
I do not have those numbers right now, Chair Winters. I can get those for you, though. Active shooter incidents and, of course, vehicle and improvements in equipment and infrastructure continue to be budget drivers for us. Thank you for your time today, and if you have any more questions.
Thank you very much for your presentation.
Thank you.
It's a good time, and unless someone else has something else to add, because we will continue with the Oregon State Police tomorrow, and unless the...
Sure. Chair Winters, Travis Tampa for the record. Our presentations are in about 15-minute increments, so probably running out of time for the day.
Okay. Thank you. I'll see you tomorrow. I was talking to Das.
Oh. Hopefully, definitely better.
Okay. If there's no further questions, or we are adjourned.
Thank you.
We are adjourned.
Thank you.
Sorry.